every night over the course of a few decades, you'll see about 59% of the surface of the moon because it wiggles a little bit off of its perfect tidal locking. But what this paper points out is that with M-type stars, if you've got a planet with a capacity to support life orbiting about it, it doesn't matter what kind of tidal locking you're going to get. You're going to get some kind of tidal locking, and that some kind of tidal locking is going to lead to a climate instability. And these three authors from UC Berkeley and the University of Hawaii basically point out this has not been taken into account. There's all this enthusiasm in the astronomical community. Let's pursue these M-type stars. We're going to find life on planets orbiting these M-type stars. And this paper basically is throwing water on that hypothesis, pun intended. Basically making the point, no, with the tidal locking, you're going to get a climate instability. And sorry about these chemistry equations, but this kind of makes the point that, you know, with temperature differences, you get weather. I mean, you know, it's colder at nighttime than it is at daytime, and that is a factor in generating weather. In fact, what generates storms is you'll have a cold spot in one part of the planet and a hot spot in another part of the planet. That's going to generate a weather system. And with weathering, you're going to get a chemical transformation of the planet. And so this is what's been going on here on planet Earth for some time, is that you've got oceans and continents. And the continents are essentially made up of silicates. And you've got water falling on the silicates. That's rainfall. So if you've got rain falling on these silicates, it will cause the silicates to weather, and you get this chemical reaction, where carbon dioxide combines with the water and the silicates to make calcium and, you know, hydrogen carbonate and sand, silicon dioxide. And the calcium, of course, is also going to react. But the bottom line is you wind up with silicate and carbon dioxide going to calcium carbonate and silicon dioxide. And the carbonates and sand are actually good for us because these are components we use to make concrete and all other kinds of building materials. So we actually benefit from this reaction. But notice what it does. Water acts as a catalyst and takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. But what this paper is pointing out is that where you've got tidal locking in one shape or form, it's going to cause increased weathering, which means you're going to be pulling up the carbon dioxide at a much faster rate than what happens here on the Earth. And you say, isn't this going to be bad news for planet Earth? No, you want the carbon dioxide to be slowly leached out of the atmosphere because the sun is getting brighter and brighter as it gets older and older. And carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, so the fact that you've got carbon dioxide being slowly leached out of our atmosphere actually compensates for the sun getting brighter and brighter. So our atmosphere becomes progressively less and less efficient to trap heat as the sun gets brighter and brighter, keeping the temperature in the surface of the Earth ideal for life over billions of years. However, you run into a problem if you accelerate the weathering. And basically that's what this author is pointing out here, is that with a tidally locked planet, it's going to be a whole lot colder at night than it is, say, here on the Earth, and a whole lot warmer. I mean, you see that on the moon. Notice when the astronauts went up to the moon, they had to carry 300 pounds of gear on their back. Now, fortunately, the gravity of the moon was one-sixth of what it is here, so 300 pounds was equivalent to only 50 pounds. And you can kind of walk around with a 50-pound pack. It's not that bad. A lot of us have backpacked and carried a lot more than that. You can do that. But the reason why they had to have a 300-pound pack on their back was to have an internal heating and air conditioning system, because of the fact that on the moon you've got these extreme temperature differences. So, you know, at nighttime it drops down to close to absolute zero, and at daytime it gets up to hundreds of degrees. And that happens when you've got a tidally locked body. It's going to be, because, you know, after all, it's going to be slowly rotating, and therefore it's going to be really cold at night and very hot in the daytime. But what this paper is pointing out is that, you know, what People who are enthusiastic about these planets are saying, well, that's okay. What if you're on the Twilight Zone? I don't know if many of you remember that old TV show, The Twilight Zone. Well, they're pointing out the Twilight Zone can be a good thing. If you're at the Twilight Zone, then you're in between the extreme heat of the daytime and the extreme cold of the nighttime. And if it's really close to being tidally locked, the Twilight Zone is relatively permanent. And so they say that's the place where we're going to get liquid water. And so that's kind of the whole enthusiasm of those people looking at these M-type stars saying, okay, you're not going to get liquid water over the whole of the surface, but maybe you can have liquid water at the Twilight Zone. Okay, now we've been doing podcasts pointing out there's a problem with the Twilight Zone because with the tidal locking of the moon, it wiggles a bit. And so you're not going to have that Twilight Zone perfectly locked. Although in some cases the locking could be a lot better than it is on the moon. But what these three authors are pointing out is, no matter how good the tidal locking is and how stable that Twilight Zone might be for liquid water, you're still going to have the situation where you're going to have hot zones on the planet and cold zones on the planet close together. This is also going to be true of the Twilight Zone. Because on one side of the Twilight Zone is going to be really hot, and the other side of the Twilight Zone is going to be really cold, and guess what that does? It generates really fierce storms. And so you're going to get extreme weathering. The extreme weathering is going to accelerate mechanisms like this. And by the way, this is the only one they discuss. They discuss two different weathering mechanisms that destabilize the climate of the planet and basically wind up thinning the atmosphere and causing the difference between the boiling point of water and the freezing point of water to shrink. That's what happened to Mars. As its atmosphere got stripped away, the air pressure dropped, and with the dropping of the air pressure, you wind up where today the freezing point of water is identical to the boiling point of water on Mars. So if you do get liquid water on Mars today, that liquid water is only going to hang around for 1 or 2 seconds before it evaporates and dissipates to outer space. So once the temperature difference between freezing and boiling becomes very small, you've got a situation where the planet rapidly loses its water. So this paper is basically saying M-type stars really aren't a good candidate for life. I'll take some questions. What happened to the silicon?
The last term in the upper equation. The last three terms.
Point out what's going on here.
Up above. Yeah.
There?
Yeah.
Yeah?
What happened to the silicon in the last term?
These are two reactions, and this is the net reaction. That's two separate. Yeah, those are two separate reactions. See, we got to figure out what happens to this. So I took this part out. You can ignore that part and go over to here, and you get this reaction, but this is the net effect. Sorry. Yeah. You're going 1, 2, 3. That's not what we were doing there. So always helps to have some of these sharp engineers in the audience who can just pick this stuff up like that. Okay, yes.
Does bicarbonate of soda have anything to do with
that? Bicarbonate of soda have anything to do with that? Well, you do get, it's good that term down there will help you. Yeah, okay.
Is it possible that, what's the moons of Saturn, Europa, and the other one?
Yes.
They think that they have water. Just recently, not too long ago, I think the Russians drilled down in the, in the North Pole, where they found this Lake Vostok, a huge lake that lies under the ice.
That's in Antarctica, yes.
Antarctica, and it's been isolated for lots and lots of years. Well, it's possible, it's still possible that some of these planets, the small planets, over like Saturn, could have underground water and some kind of life.
Well, see, when you're looking at Jupiter and Saturn, you're beyond what's called the ice line. The ice line is that distance from the star where gases will freeze. And so that's how you get the big planets forming there. You can't get big planets forming inside the ice line. because the gases won't freeze and they're very easily dissipated by the heat of the sun. So it explains why we got rocky planets in close and gas giants far away. Now, interestingly, with these M-type stars, we are seeing lots of Neptune and Uranus-type planets orbiting in close. In fact, that's a big problem for trying to find a life support planet. If you've got a Neptune wandering around in the zone where you've got rocky planets, that Neptune-sized planet will disrupt the orbits of the rocky planets and make them unfit for life. And that's a very common feature with these M-type stars. But the difference there is those Neptune-type planets that are orbiting in close must have formed farther away and drifted inward. An inward drift of planets is something we're seeing very frequently amongst these extrasolar planets. And so it's telling us one of the unique features of our solar system, our gas giants did not inwardly drift. But as we look at other extrasolar planetary systems, that's a very common feature, which is deadly for the existence of life. This article here is pointing out there's another problem, namely that you're going to get storms that are much more fierce than on planet Earth, and this is going to cause a runaway climate instability, which will make the planet unfit for life. But they do close the paper off by saying, we're not ruling out the possibility that life can exist on one of these planets for a few minutes. We're only eliminating the possibility that life could exist for any significant period of time. And also they're pointing out that bacteria are still in the running, again, for very short periods of time. But as far as anything more advanced than that, it's ruled out. Now, I think the point you're making, Al, is once we get up to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, you're going to have a lot of water. As I said, water is the second most abundant molecule in the universe. So the moons of Saturn and Jupiter are water-rich. Now, it's cold out there. So the question is there any possibility you could have liquid water on the moons of Jupiter and Saturn? And the answer is you're only going to have that happen if you get tidal friction. So with tidal locking, you're going to get tidal heating. And so there's speculation that Europa, for example, which is 35% water, the planet is 35%, or the moon is 35% water. Our planet Earth is 0.02% water. Europa is 35%, and there's another moon of Jupiter that's actually 65% water. So water's there. But if it's all frozen, that's not going to really help people that are speculating about the existence of life. But what they're saying about Europa is maybe it's close enough to Jupiter that it gets tidally heated by the tidal friction with Jupiter. And that being the case, maybe it's frozen on the outside, but maybe on the inside it might be liquid. Now, it's speculative because no one has actually measured the tidal heating that Jupiter exerts on Europa. And so that's why when I spoke to NASA, I said, you know, before you guys spend $2 to $3 billion going to Europa to drill a hole through 26 kilometers minimum of ice and then put down a little movie camera to see if there's any bacteria down there, it might be a good idea to send a satellite that simply orbits Europa. Very cheap. And that will tell you how much tidal heating you got, because wouldn't it be embarrassing to go to Europa and drill a hole through and say, gee, it's ice all the way down. So if you, you know, spend a few million dollars to measure the tidal heating and then go and drill your way through. So, but yeah, it's possible. But I would argue that, you know, it'd be nice to kind of explore the interior of Europa, but I'm not so sure it's worth the money to send a movie camera down there and swim around and look for bacteria, because we already know that the ice thickness is a minimum of 26 kilometers. And if it's that thick minimum, then the nutrients that life would need that do exist on the surface aren't going to make it to the interior water if liquid water is there. So in one sense, yeah, I don't mind them drilling through to, you know, learn a lot about the geology of these water-rich satellites, but forget about the idea of looking for bacteria. We already know the nutrients that the bacteria would need are not available. Yeah, in the back.
Hi. Does the fact that they say that they're looking for life increase funding
Oh, very much does. So.
They keep saying these things because they know it's going to increase their
cost. Well, I was speaking up in the Bay Area just a couple of days ago, and there were a number of NASA scientists in the audience, and I said, you know, yes, this does bring funding to the NASA, endeavors, but be careful because it could be short-lived. I mean, if you keep saying, you know, we're going to find life, and then you discover, well, you know, we were a little bit too optimistic in our advertising towards the public, you might turn the public off. And so what I was recommending is let's do this, exploration, but can't we take life off the table? We're going to go there to learn about the, planetary physics. And the more we learn about the moons and planets of our solar system, and the more we learn about moons outside of our solar system, the more we learn about planet Earth. And everybody's interested in learning more about our home planet, right? So that's one way to sustain the funding of NASA. But if you start telling them things that aren't going to possibly bear fruit, you might eventually sour the funding. In fact, NASA funding has already been dropped. The Obama administration has cut the funding significantly, so there's real concern about, can we sustain this? Well, I think there's a way to keep the public interest up, but let's be honest with the public. Yes?
Is Pluto water rich?
Is Pluto water rich? We don't really know. It's far enough away that it's difficult for us to tell. In all likelihood, it is, because after all, it's out there in the Kuiper Belt of asteroids and comets. And we know that the average water abundance of those bodies is about 80%. So, yeah, Pluto could be 80-85% water. So, but we really don't know for sure. Yes?
Are our gas giants frozen gas?
Yes. Our gas giants are frozen gas. So, now, Jupiter has gases that are true gases because it's close enough to the sun that, for example, methane is not in a frozen state. But once you get out to Saturn and beyond, even methane becomes, methane becomes liquid, and if you go far enough away, it becomes frozen.
On this life issue, it sounds like your adage about, well, let's just wait a little while and we'll see.
Right. Well, I mean, people are all excited, for example, about Titan, the biggest moon going around Saturn, because it rains there. It doesn't rain water, it rains methane. Methane is liquid. It's so cold there that methane is actually a liquid, and they've now got measurements showing that they actually have precipitation of liquid drops of methane falling from the sky. So, there are no more questions. Let me jump into, we got one more.
Determination of tidal heating.
Well, if you can put a satellite in orbit around Europa, for example, you can measure very carefully the gravitational potential all over the surface. And that will tell you immediately what kind of interaction you're getting with Jupiter. You're basically setting up a three-body problem. And by measuring the gravitational field on the surface of Europa all over the surface, you're going to get a really good idea of just what the tidal forces between Jupiter and Europa will be. And it's really the only way to find out. I mean, you can get a guess from the surface of the Earth by looking at the dynamics of the systems of moons around Jupiter, but the error bars are large. The only way to really nail it down is to put a satellite in orbit. But as I was pointing out to the NASA scientists, that's a relatively cheap mission to do that. And, it might be good to do that around a few of the other big satellites of Jupiter as well, because that would also tell you a lot about the mean motion resonances of the four big satellites of Jupiter, which is an unanswered question. We know the mean motion resonances are significant, but we haven't been able to measure it accurately. I think it'd be fun to send a mission out to Jupiter and have a satellite orbit the farthest out satellite first and send it to orbit the next one, and let's pick up all four of the big satellites by that measure. And as a bonus, we'll know whether or not there's liquid water underneath the thick ice of Europa.
Wouldn't you expect some, I mean, if there was tidal heating, wouldn't you expect some temperature gradient from the surface? And you might be able to detect those?
Well, that works for Io. You know, Io is so close to Jupiter that the tidal heating results in geysers and volcanoes. And that's something we can actually see. So we know the tidal heating there is significant. But what we're talking about is a planet that could have stable liquid water underneath the ice. Io is too close to Jupiter for that to be a possibility. The tidal heating there is too extreme. And as we go out to the two more distant big moons of Jupiter, we know that tidal heating is not enough. I forget which one has 65% water, whether it's Callisto or Ganymede, but one of them is 65% water, but it's too far from Jupiter for it to be liquid. It's frozen all the way down. The big question is, Europa seems to be in that Goldilocks zone where the tidal heating may be just right. But emphasis on the maybe, we really don't know. It might be slush, it might be frozen, it might be liquid, we just don't know. The water may even be hot. Yes.
I believe Callisto is the water-rich one, but going back to what you're talking about, nutrients getting down from the surface to the liquid water there below, how does that relate to our drilling into Lake Vostok and seeing life down there that is billions of years old, which and how that process has managed to maintain itself?
Well, that's kind of the excitement about Lake Vostok, is that maybe there's life underneath the ice cap over Lake Vostok. And actually, it factors into the Europa question. There are scientists saying, if we can find bacteria in Lake Vostok, wouldn't that prove that bacteria could possibly exist on Europa? Well, there's a couple of caveats there. Number one, the ice isn't as thick over Lake Vostok as it is on Europa. Europa's ice is a lot thicker. And number two, we know that there's liquid water underneath there. Just the pressure of the ice and the temperature of Antarctica guarantees there will be liquid water underneath there. In fact, they've already drilled through and proved there's liquid water there. But the other big caveat is we know that planet Earth is very life-rich, and that therefore the possibility that life outside of the ice cap previously invaded the liquid water is very much a possibility. Whereas in the case on Europa, you've got a permanent situation where you've got this thick ice cap that would be over top of any possibly existing liquid water without the benefit of mesophiles, which is life existing under optimal conditions, infecting the zone. So we know that, for example, Antarctica hasn't always been at the South Pole, and therefore it could have been infected a long time ago, and bacteria have the capability of hanging around a long time. So my response is whatever they find in Lake Vostok is irrelevant to Europa. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if we find bacteria in Lake Vostok, because after all, our planet is so incredibly rich in life that infection is a virtual a guarantee. So, yes.
We're supposed to have the first 30 minutes.
We've done a half hour of scientific discovery, so if you give you at least 10 minutes and no questions, we can move on to the next topic, please.
Yes, let's segue to the lesson, Human Origins, Psalm 139. This is where we ended up last time, pointing out that we can calibrate the Genesis 11 genealogy and come up with a rough date, a crude date for when Adam lived, of roughly 60,000 years ago, plus or minus 30,000. People last week were complaining, how come the dates are so crude? Well, after all, it's based on two calibration points only. In Genesis 11, you got the name Abraham and you got the name Peleg. Peleg is the fifth one mentioned in the 10 names that run from Noah down to Abraham. For Abraham, we have an undisputedly reliable date for when he lived, because his name shows up in the Akkadian tablets, the Sumerian tablets, and also in the Bible. And in both cases, there's enough historical detail recorded there that we know that Abraham lived roughly 4,000 years ago. Now, The Bible also tells us that Abraham lived to be 175 years. So when you say the time of Abraham, well, it could be 3,900 years ago, 4,100 years ago, 4,000 years ago. So you're going to get a bit of slop right there. What do you mean by the time of Abraham? The guy lived a long time. Then we got Peleg, which tells us in Genesis 10:25, which, by the way, the significance of chapter 10, I didn't emphasize this last week. Genesis 10 is the table of nations. That's how it's labeled in most Bibles. But it'd be better labeled the migration of the nations. Because what it's really talking about is the events recorded in the first part of Genesis 11, where you've got the human species, after the flood, refusing to fulfill God's command. God commanded Adam and Eve, multiply and fill the earth. They didn't do it. The flood was one of the consequences of humanity refusing to spread throughout the earth. And so when the flood is over, God talks to Noah again. But if you read it carefully in the Bible, you notice that God ups the rhetoric. He really emphasizes to Noah the importance of multiplying and filling the earth. But what do we see recorded in Genesis 11? Humanity is resolute in staying. We're going to remain in one place. We're going to build this city and this tower. What does the text say? So we will not be scattered over the face of the earth. Refusing to obey God's command to multiply and fill the earth. And we mentioned last week why that's important. It's important to restrain oppression and evil. If all you got is one nation ruling over all people, don't be surprised if the government becomes oppressive. If the government has no competition from other governments of other nations, oppression is virtually a guarantee. And so that's why God wanted many nations spread throughout the earth, competing with one another for citizens. It's a check on oppression and evil. And so God forcibly scatters humanity over the face of the earth, and that's the context of Genesis 10. God taking humanity out of the region of the Persian Gulf and the Mesopotamian plain and scattering them over the face of the earth. And as I mentioned last week, we actually have DNA evidence why chromosome DNA analysis and mitochondrial DNA analysis that confirms that there was this very early, extremely rapid episode of human migration. The DNA analysis is sufficiently accurate to actually show us where the migration routes were and what time they took place. And basically the two most significant migration routes were on the south shore of Asia, the eastern shore of Africa, and then the western shore of North America and South America. And the migration was incredibly aggressive and rapid. For example, in North and South America, it started at the Bering Strait and reached the southern tip of South America in less than 1,000 years. That's how fast the migration went. But the other thing that DNA evidence shows us is the migration was very early, extremely aggressive, really brief, and then suddenly stopped. So people kind of spread throughout the whole of the earth, and then they stopped migrating. Now, part of the context is what you see in Genesis 10, verse 25, where it says, the world was divided in the days of Peleg. And I believe one way of interpreting that text is that God separated the land bridges of the earth in such a way as to prevent people from remigrating back into one place. They were now scattered over the face of the earth, and now there were barriers preventing them from coming back and repeating the errors that took place in the days before the flood and the days after the flood. And last week I reviewed for you some of the geography that we've been able to nail down thanks to carbon-14 dating that shows us, for example, that Alaska and Siberia were joined together with a 500-mile-wide bridge for about a 40,000-year period during the last ice age. But at the close of the last ice age, when the ice began to melt at a rapid rate, that 500-mile-wide bridge became a strait. And it became a 60-mile-wide strait, 80 miles wide, actually, with very treacherous water in between that prevented people that had migrated over to North and South America from coming back. In fact, they were literally cut off for 10,000 years They wanted to come back, but they couldn't come back because it was just so treacherous. And likewise, I was mentioning last week how the Haida Indians in the Queen Charlotte Islands had migrated over a land bridge. This is all in their totem pole legends and the Longhouse legends, how they had migrated from the mainland of British Columbia to the Queen Charlotte's. Then they observed a rapid rise in the sea level and attempted to go back, but the sea levels came up so fast they weren't able to do it and were literally cut off for 10,500 years from the rest of humanity. Now, that happened between Britain and France. Britain and France were joined by a land bridge, and then it got separated, and likewise with Australia. There wasn't a land bridge that joined the Asiatic mainland to Australia, but what happened is there was a period of time, the close of the last ice age, where it was very easy island hops in warm water, and water that was not too treacherous. So people could literally see where the next island was, and this is literally how Australia got to be inhabited. But then with the rising of the sea levels, that was no longer a possibility, and the Aborigines in Australia literally were cut off from the rest of humanity, again, for more than 10,000 years. And you say, how's that possible when you're only looking at 60, 80, or 100 miles? Well, the problem when you form, when you separate two big land masses and you form a strait in between, you tend to set up ocean currents and tidal streaming in the straits that makes it very treacherous for people across the strait unless they got modern shipping capability. And so, yeah, by the time we get up to the 19th century, now you can cross the Bering Strait, but before that, you'd be risking your life to cross, say, the Hecate Strait from British Columbia over to the Queen Charlotte's. Because, you know, some of us have been through that strait, and you can actually see the tidal streaming running up at 20, 30 knots through the strait. And that happens at all these different straits. That's why it's so difficult to swim the English Channel. It's not just that the water is cold, you've got currents and the tides running up there, which make that quite difficult. So that's the whole basis for coming to the biblical date for Adam. And as a bonus, you also come up with a rough date for when Noah lived and when the flood took place, which puts you in the neighborhood of 40,000 years, plus or minus 15,000 years ago. Now, you'll see in the literature, scientific literature, more accurate dates being expressed for human origins and for events that took place after human origins. And I mentioned this at the very end of my message last week. Don't trust those dates. Almost always those are thermoluminescence dates or optical luminescence dates. They're not radiocarbon dates. And you say, well, why don't we come up with radiocarbon dates? If you're talking 40 and 60,000 years ago, carbon-14 dating just isn't that reliable because the half-life for carbon-14 is 5,715 years. And with any radiometric technique, the technique is reliable if you're about a factor of 5 or 6 away from the half-life, but once you get beyond that, it ceases to be reliable. And I didn't mention this in the class, but we talked about it after class. This is one reason why there's some controversy over JPL coming up with a date for the Shroud of Turin, because they determined the date to be 13th century AD by carbon-14 dating. But 13th century is only 700 years away from the present. With a half-life of 5,715 years, you're now outside of that range of reliability. And the Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientist said, we know we're outside the range, so we're saying roughly 13th century. And they said, if you want a more accurate date, just give us a bigger piece of the shroud. All they were given was 4 square inches. They say, give us a square foot, and we can knock the error bar down considerably. And that's the problem. The farther you get away from the half-life, the bigger the sample size you need, and the purer the sample size must be. And therefore, when you're talking 60,000 years ago, unless you have an exceptionally large sample that is very pure without any contaminants, that means material with different ages in it, you're just not going to get a reliable carbon-14 date. And so that's why you see in the scientific literature, when they're talking about human origins, they're typically relying on thermoluminescence dating and optical luminescence dating. Yes.
Well, if you had, say, a 6,000-year-old fabric, but it had been near a fire 50 years ago, where materials that were 100 years old burned and a lot of that soot got onto that fabric, wouldn't that really filter your heating of that fabric?
It would, but on the other hand, you'd pick it up, because you immediately get a really big error bar on the carbon-14 measurement. And people who do this kind of dating look for that. If they see a really big error bar, then what they do is they take smaller pieces of the sample with the hope that they can isolate the contaminant from the original source. And so often what you'll see in carbon-14, you'll see this with all radiometric dating, where they have a contamination possibility or probability, they will, you know, take a, they'll try to get a gross date, then they'll actually date the little tiny bits of samples, hoping to isolate the contaminant, and they quote you three dates. They'll quote a date that they think is best for the contaminant, one for the original source, then an average for the whole sample. Now, I say that because sometimes critics of radiometric dating will say, hey, look at this published report. They have three dates that are widely separated from one another. Well, if you read the fine print, you'll figure out why they have three such different dates from the same technique. It's because they recognize they're dealing with a contamination issue, which is why I said if we know ahead of time that the sample is pure without contamination, you can get a reliable result even if you're outside of that factor of five or six. But you're going to need a really pure sample, and moreover, you're going to need a much bigger sample. You're not going to just take a little piece of it and get an accurate date. And typically, when you get to 50 and 60, even if you've got a big sample that is pure, you're still not going to get a reliable date. Now you're a factor of 10 away from the half-life. And when you're a factor of 10 away, literally all bets are off. And you say, well, what's wrong with the thermoluminescence and the optical luminescence? We discussed this about a half hour after class last week. Sometimes the best stuff happens a half hour after class. The analogy there is you're simply measuring the fading of the luminescence. And a good analogy is you can buy these, in fact, I did this with my sons, as I put star patterns up on their ceilings with these phosphorescent stars. With the idea that maybe they'd be able to figure out how the North Star, I put the Big Dipper up there, the North Star. I wanted them to be able to, you know, figure out where true North is whenever the sky is clear. So they got lost when they were 30 years of age. They remember back to their childhood. Say, oh yeah, that's right. That's how you get to the North Star, and that's North. I'm not sure how well that's working, but we'll see. But it also had a wonderful side effect because my younger son, for example, we would put him to bed and tell him to go to sleep. But he would turn the light on and start reading. And you know, I would come in, say, at 10:30 at night and walk in and notice that the stars were all bright on the ceiling. So I knew exactly what he had been doing. He had re-illuminated the phosphorescent stars. So he got busted. So, in fact, I could tell how long he'd been reading the book. And you know, he was stunned. You know, Dad, how do you know all this stuff? So, and I didn't tip my hand for several more years. I didn't want him catching on. But the same thing applies here, is that if you're going to a site and you're looking at these phosphorescent minerals and measuring how the light is dimmed in them, it all depends how well it's been illuminated and whether it's been re-illuminated any time in the recent past. Bottom line is, with both thermal and optical luminescence, all you get is an upper limit. It's that or less. And that's important when you're reading the scientific literature where they talk about, well, we found modern humans in South Africa that date back 85,000 years. Well, if you read the fine print, they got an optical luminescence measurement for that date. And by the way, at that date, that's all you're going to get anyway. And so it's 85,000 years or less. It can't be more than 85,000 years, but it certainly could be a lot less. And probably a classic example of that is what happened with the Jimnian Cave in Australia, where they had an optical luminescence date showing that Aborigines were inhabiting that cave 60,000 years ago. And that was a problem in the scientific community because it contradicted other data that demonstrated that the Aborigines couldn't have gotten there that early. And for one thing, the land bridges that they would need weren't set up that early. And so that was a conundrum. But people were insisting that indeed they had to be there 60,000 years ago. Well, it was about a decade ago now, almost a decade ago, where they actually found some artifacts in that Jinian cave that they were able to carbon 14 date and determined that the 60,000 year date needed to be revised to 3,000 years ago. So it was literally off by a factor of 20 times. And you say, well, you know, how could that be? Well, I mean, you really need to make some assumptions about how the artifacts are buried and cut off from light, or whether they've been re-exposed by animals and exposed to light. Now, where you can do a little better is where you've got an artifact where you've got thermal luminescence and optical luminescence measurements. Why? Because the decay of the temperature and the decay of the light typically will run at different rates. And they run at different rates, that helps you sort out some of the assumptions. It's still not as reliable as a radiometric date, but it is a whole lot better than if all you've got is a thermal luminescence date or an optical luminescence date. And that's a reason for a lot of the confusion that's going on. When did the Denisovans live? When did the Neanderthals live? And at what point did they get into Europe? How did they overlap, or whether or not they overlapped human beings? All this is a problem because of the fact we don't have good dating methods. But we're trying to keep up with that. Fuzz has written a number of articles on new evidence that shows that Neanderthals were gone from Europe by 48,000 years ago and therefore could not have overlapped human beings. But the error bar there is still plus or minus 5,000 years. Dates, error bars are large. But back to Noah. So 40,000, give or take 15,000 years ago. And by the way, you need to understand what I mean by these dates. That is a standard deviation, which means that there's a 67% probability that Noah lived between 25,000 years ago and 55,000 years ago. Notice that's not a certainty. That's only a 67% probability. You say, well, what if I want a 95% probability? Then double that figure. You want, so with 95% certainty, we can say that Noah lived between 10,000 years ago and 70,000 years ago. Gee, doesn't sound too impressive, does it? But that's just the nature of the assumptions we're building into this and the dates. However, I would argue there's another way to kind of pin down these dates with a little more precision. And keep in mind that we don't have a good radiometric dating tool between 50,000 years ago and, say, 1 million years ago. There's not a single radiometric tool we can go to. So you say, why do they use these thermal luminescence and optical luminescence dating techniques? It's because that's all we have. Okay. There's another way we can go, and what we notice is that these dates of 40,000 years ago for the flood of Noah and roughly 60,000 years ago for the time of Adam are consistent with what we know about the geology of the Arabian Peninsula. So this is what the Arabian Peninsula looks like now. But we can actually look at erosion rates that are taking place in the Arabian Peninsula and take it back to the time when we know that snow covered the mountains of Havilah and the mountains of Cush. Where did you come up with these names? Out of Genesis 2. Genesis 2 talks about the Tigris and the Euphrates flowing out of the land of Asher. And those rivers still flow today. It's Assyria or Iraq. And so that's where Asher is. But if you read Genesis 2, it tells us that two other rivers, the Gihon and the Pishon, flowed out of Havilah, the mountains of Havilah and the mountains of Cush. So the Gihon flows out of Cush, and the Pishon flows out of the mountains of Havilah. Now today, those mountains are bone dry, which is why those rivers are simply riverbeds. They no longer flow. The Tigris and the Euphrates still flow. Why? Because you've got the mountains of Ararat that are still snow-covered. So the melting of that snow will feed those rivers. And so those are permanent flowing rivers. But the Havilah, or pardon me, the Gihon and the Pishon only flow when you get one of these very rare rain showers falling upon the Arabian Peninsula. The rest of the time, they're dry. So we call them Wadi. A Wadi is a dry riverbed. But the Wadis of the Gihon and the Pishon are so enormous that we know they must have been fed by a lot of water at one time. Now, you can go online and get a much higher resolution image of this is from NASA. It's a satellite imagery. And what I got here is a relatively low resolution image. But if you go online, you can get a high resolution image, which will actually show you the ancient riverbeds of the Gihon, which flows out of these mountains of Kush, and then the Pishon, which flows out of the mountains here of Havilah. And so back at the end of the last ice age, these were covered with snow and ice, and snow and ice as well covered those mountains. But more than that, the end of the last ice age, what we now call the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf were largely dry. Now, please don't read too much precision into what I've done there. I was basically playing around with my keynote, trying to fill in the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. In order to do it, I had to kind of fill in the whole thing. But the truth is, there would have been significant lakes that would have existed with the Persian Gulf. So in that Persian Gulf area, would have been about 90 to 95% dry, but there have been about 5 to 10% water in that area. But just think of it as big lakes. In the case of the Red Sea, it may have only been 70% dry, 80% dry, so there would have been big lakes there as well. But I wasn't able to kind of show you with any precision where the lakes would be, and for that matter, we're not even sure where those lakes were. But we are certain that at that time, 40 to 50,000 years ago, most of the Persian Gulf was dry land, and most of the Red Sea was dry land. Now, this helps us understand some of the biblical history, where it talks about Adam and Eve, and how the Garden of Eden was in a location where four great rivers came together, the Gihon, Pishon, Tigris, and the Euphrates. And there's only one place on the globe today where those four rivers could come together, basically in the south eastern portion of what is now the Persian Gulf. So that's where I think the Garden of Eden would have been located, just simply based on where can you get the four rivers coming to one get into one place, because that's what you see in Genesis 2. It talks about the Garden of Eden as being the nexus, the joining place of these four great rivers, and really that's the only place on the map where you get the four rivers together. Now, what does that tell you? Adam and Eve must have been living at a time when the Persian Gulf was largely dry. So, and if you've been following our website, there's an article I put up there about 9, 10, 12 months ago where an archaeologist found 60 villages surrounding the Persian Gulf that date to be the oldest villages that anyone has ever discovered. And they got good carbon-14 dates on those villages. And it says the fact that they surrounded the Persian Gulf is evidence that people were trying to deal with a rising sea level in the Persian Gulf. And so he was speculating that there was a thriving civilization that would now be underwater. And as the sea levels rose, they basically began to move their villages up to higher and higher ground. And he actually found some evidence of villages a little bit higher up than the ones that surrounded the Persian Gulf. But the fact that they date to, you say, what are the dates of the villages? 11 to 12,000 years ago, which was a time when the sea levels were still rising. And therefore, I think he's got a good case. And in fact, he ends his article by saying, what we really need to do is find some way to bring all these nations that surround the Persian Gulf into a peaceful relationship so we can actually explore what's going on underneath the water in the Persian Gulf. But right now there's so much tension in that area that no one's going to give them a permit to actually do the kind of explorations that's necessary. But there again, he also closes the paper off by saying, you know, the events which would have flooded the Persian Gulf may have so destroyed the villages we may not find anything anyway. But he says it'd be worth a look. Yes?
How do we compare or reconcile this with the evidence from life originating in Eastern Africa?
Good question. You notice there's a bridge joining the mountains of Kush with the mountains of Kush that are on the other side of Africa. Today we identify Kush with Ethiopia. In fact, it tells us in the Bible that the Queen of Sheba came from Kush. And that would have been approximately where Ethiopia is today. But notice that you can start in the Garden of Eden and walk up the Gihon River, and it puts you right into the mountains of Kush. And if you keep going, you wind up in Ethiopia.
And it's not too far.
It's not too far, and you got a land bridge all the way across.
And they were driven out of that original area.
Well, this is the context of Genesis 10. Humanity was resolute in staying in the Persian Gulf oasis and into Mesopotamia. That's the context of the beginning of Genesis chapter 11, where they're going to build this big city and this tower, and then God forcibly scatters them over the face of the earth. And so where are they going to go? Well, one easy way to go is go up the riverbed. And so that would have put them quite early into Africa, and therefore spread throughout Africa. And actually, we have DNA evidence that documents that the Eastern and Southern Africans have the greatest genetic diversity of any human ethnic group on the planet. But that's not at all unexpected from a biblical perspective, because that's the easiest migration route out of that region. Trying to get into India and China, Australia, North and South America is a much bigger deal. So there's really nothing extraordinary about the fact that we find all that genetic diversity in that region. That would be the easiest of the migration routes in the context of Genesis chapter 10. Yes?
So you're saying that the migration came from Eden into Africa instead of the other way around, which is like they're finding, they just found a 2 million human skeleton northeast of Johannesburg. So you're saying that they came from Eden into Africa instead of from Africa into the rest of the world. That doesn't jive with the...
Well, keep in mind that those research studies are presuming that where you got the greatest genetic diversity is where you're going to have the earliest migration. I'm saying that's consistent with this. Okay? But
many other anthropologists say that.
Well, there's a few caveats that you want to make on those assumptions about where the birth of humanity took place. It only follows that you're going to get the greatest genetic diversity with the earliest humans if we human beings are random migrators and consistent migrators. The DNA evidence tells us otherwise, that there is a period of stability, then rapid migration, followed by a very long period of stability. In which case, simply trying to find the place where you got the greatest genetic diversity really doesn't tell you where the first humans came from. All it really does is document where these aggressive migration routes were and where the first of these migration routes took place. If indeed humanity started off in the Persian Gulf, we would expect that the easiest migration route would be exploited first. Then thereafter, you would get the Asiatic migration route. And last of all, you're going to get the most difficult one, which is the one that goes into North and South America. And that's exactly what the DNA evidence tells us. There's Africa first, then Asia, then Australia, last of all, North and South America. So I think, that part's reliable. The rest of it, look at the assumptions. And the assumptions could very easily be called into question.
Also, the cradle of civilization happens to also be very close to there. But for that, it's time for us to end and migrate out of the room.
Yeah, we need to migrate out of the room. Dave there added a very good point, is that the Persian oasis is where you see the Neolithic Revolution. So that's where civilization gets launched first. And, you would expect that that would be consistent where with people got started off. Maybe so, maybe not, but it's certainly consistent with the idea that that would be the birthplace, and civilization would take place later as you move out of the Persian Gulf oasis and Assyria. But now we're talking dates 11, 12,000 years ago. So what's interesting is that people aggressively migrated 40, 50,000 years ago. North and South America, we're talking 11, 12,000 years ago. Then stayed put, but it took a long time after that, with the exception of the Persian Gulf area, to get civilization launched. And so that's something else I want us to study, why it takes so long to get civilization going. When you're migrating, you're not going to be developing technology. You got to wait till you stop migrating, set up villages, cities, a nation. Then you've got the context for developing civilization. What the evidence tells us, it happened first in the Persian Gulf and Mesopotamian regions. Okay, next week we're actually going to look at a model of the flood that we've developed, a little bit bigger than your traditional flood model. We're not. Next week we're talking Easter, right? 2 weeks from now. We'll get into that. We'll also get into some of the post-flood geology. And then we'll move on into what can we learn from the cultural big bangs. So, Father in Heaven, we want to thank you that we live in a day and an age where we can explore in such detail in the book of nature what your book of scripture has been stating for thousands of years. Lord, may this build our faith and our confidence in your inspired word. And Father, I pray that especially during this Easter time, you would give all of us your opportunities to share the good news of how you, the creator of the universe, became a human being and then spent time here on planet Earth with us, gave us an example of humility, and then paid the ransom price so that all of us, if we so choose, can be delivered from this creation to a far better life in the new creation. In Jesus' name, amen.